The chances of poison in the air supply are not insignificant.
Listening to him work out a problem was almost as much fun as listening to Nathaniel.
Figure I do it in the busy bee wearing a Mars suit. Should be fine that way, but we probably won't need it.
Understood. Parker shut the mic down and sat, staring out at the void as the minutes ticked past. He sighed and reached for the mic again, switching it to the med mod.
Shimon, keep me posted on their telemetry, would you? If Tarazis' lithium hydroxide canister gets low, we'll call it sooner.
I have my eyes on it. Everything is within acceptable parameters.
You would think oxygen would be the big worry on a spacewalk, but that's the consumable we can pack most efficiently. Carbon dioxide scrubbing, battery life, these are the things you worry about on an EVA. The oxygen is the least of the worries. You'll overheat before you run out of air. At a certain point, I ran out of equations and joined Parker in staring into space as we listened to Rafael and Tarazis work. It was an endless cycle of trying to pry the sizing ring bracket free, punctuated by random Portuguese curses. Finally, Parker sat forward.
30 minutes. We have to call it.
His jaw clenched.
You are go to cut the line.
Are we sure these lines are depressurized? It's like a steel rod.
Even as Parker was flipping to engineering, Leonard was back on the comm.
The gauge down here is flatlined on zero. That line is part of the permanent installation. I think that's why it's rigid.
Understood.
Parker glanced at me and we had a moment of rare rapport. The staffing on this spacewalk was all wrong. Leonard should be out there, not in engineering, which wasn't his area of specialty. Sure, he'd trained to back Rafael up, but most of his training had been on actually performing the EVAs. I could see Parker regretting his decision to use Mission Control's duty roster.
Avellino. Leonard says the gauge is at zero. He thinks the rigidity is caused because it's a permanent part of the cooling system.
Copy.
Rafael gave a small laugh.
I am only nervous about cutting my baby. I told you not to call me that. Oh, you mean the ship.
Tarazis was such a ham. We can make the repair.
Parker sighed, bending his head as if it were a prayer more than a command.
You are go to cut the line. Repeat, you are go to cut the line.
Confirmed. Cutting the line and...
Rafael suddenly cursed in Portuguese. Slapping the mic on, Parker leaned toward the speaker as if that would get him closer.
Avellino, report.
A spray of white fluttered around the viewport, twinkling in the sunlight the way the stars used to on Earth. So beautiful, but my heart froze with it as I pointed.
Parker, ammonia is venting.
Those lines should have been clear.
Some larger clumps drifted past, spinning and turning almost red in the sunlight. The sun wouldn't do that out here. That took the diffraction of an atmosphere.
We were looking at frozen blood. 26.
Esteban Tarazas, 1924 to 1963. Kansas City, Kansas, May 7th, 1963. The second casualty on the Mars mission comes a little over a month after the crew passed the midway point. Critics are pointing to the death of Esteban Tarazas as a sign of incompetence on the part of the IAC. An anonymous source high within the organization says that Captain Stetson Parker had objected to sending Tarazas out, saying that he lacked the experience but was overruled by Director Clemens. The director of the IAC characterized the death as a freak accident. According to reports, Tarazas became mired in the ammonia cooling system while doing repairs. In an attempt to free him, the crew cut an ammonia line. Tragically, a faulty gauge indicated that the lines were empty, and when cut, the pressure caused the sharp end of the metal line to whip past his suit and breach it. The suit lost integrity, subjecting Tarazas to the vacuum of space.
Cam and I floated outside the airlock. Again. I couldn't summon a single rhyme. My head was filled with the sound that Florence was piping through the ship. Sounds, really. Leonard's voice narrating as he guided Rafael back to the airlock.
Okay, reach forward with your right hand and you'll feel the guide rail at the door.
The other sound was Rafael's ragged breathing, the sound of someone trying not to sob. It hitched and tore, hissing through his teeth. Then there was heart-stopping silence as he held his breath, until it escaped again to catch on the edge of his voice. But when he spoke, God, he was professional and dead calm.
Confirmed. I have the guide rail. Good. You're going to feel my hand at your waist as I secure you. Copy.
Then the cycle of Hafael's breath began again. I rested a hand on the cold metal of the inner airlock door and leaned toward the port, looking for the men. Leonard's suit was just a dark silhouette against the darker sky. His face was lost in shadows.
Hafael's local tether is bail closed, slide lock, black on black. I'm picking up our safety tethers and heading through the hatch.
In my head, I went through the motions with him of clipping the tether hook and sliding the lock closed so that the indicator showed a solid black line.
I'm cleaning up my safety tether so we can take everything up back inside.
Beside me, Cam shifted the towel in her hands. We had practiced having an incapacitated crew member in Sims, but there is a large emotional difference between a sim and the reality. I twisted my own towel into a rope, and the soft white terry cloth added its own hush to the ship sounds. To fill the void, I said the obvious. Once Hafael's eyes are clear, I'll help Leonard get him out of his suit. Good. She drifted by the medkit she'd strapped to a socket on the side of the spindle. If he becomes combative, I have a sedative. Leonard's voice continued his quiet commentary.
We're both secured, so I'm going to guide you in.
Copy.
Nothing in his voice said that Hafael was combative. It was just a contingency, like all the other things you're prepared for. Through the port window, you could see their silhouettes come into the dim light of the airlock. Were it not for the stripes on their suits, you could not have told which man was which, except that Hafael groped for the walls, and Leonard guided him with precise movement.
We're in the airlock. I'm letting go for a moment to dog the hatch shut, but you're tethered to the interior rails.
Copy.
The suits were so bulky that you couldn't see the movement of Hafael's chest. As he drifted closer to our side of the airlock, the light slid over the curve of his helmet and lit the haze that coated the glass. His face was just a dim shape inside. I pulled myself to the side of the door to give them some room to come through. As Cam waited by the IV pressure gauge, I folded and refolded my towel as if there were some optimal way to hold it. Surely the IAC had done some sort of study on this, or some graduate student somewhere had made maximizing terry cloth their thesis. Above my head, the delta pressure gauge rose as Cam opened the IV hatch valve to let atmosphere flood into the airlock. The air roared through the valve as if a freight train were passing the spindle. It nearly drowned out Leonard's voice.
Pressure confirmed. Nearly there, Hafael.
His voice broke on a cough. My heart leapt through my chest as if it could get the airlock open. My training moved faster than that. I shoved the towel between my knees, gripping it with my legs, while I grabbed the ratchet handle and pumped it. 5 pumps to release each of the 15 latches that held the door sealed. Leonard saw me through the port. He grabbed Hafael's helmet and undogged the latches holding it on. All that redundancy fought us, as the same safeguards that kept the helmet secure slowed him down. Over the loudspeakers, we listened to Hafael aspirating his own tears. I jackknifed, still holding that damn towel between my legs, and kicked hard against the wall to haul the inner hatch open. As soon as I had a gap, I let inertia carry it the rest of the way and swam forward, grabbing the towel. Hafael, bless him, held still even though his hands jerked and twitched in distress. They didn't fight Leonard as he yanked Hafael's helmet free. Training might say that it wasn't possible to drown in your own tears, but globules of salt water and snot floated into the airlock. His eyes and nose and mouth were coated with silvery balls. I slapped him in the face with the towel. The recoil pushed him back from the water just a little, and the towel started absorbing stuff. Now he moved and lifted a hand to guide the towel into his mouth. Coughing and spitting, he cleared the salt water while Leonard braced him. Outside the airlock, Cam glanced up at the speaker.
Parker, we have him. Hafael is secured.
Confirmed.
I have never heard so much relief in a single word.
Good work.
At that, Hafael's flagging control cracked.
Good work!
He flung the towel away.
I fucking killed him!
I caught his gloved hands and pressed them tight together between mine. The cold of space's shadow still permeated the material and bled into my bones.
Sweetie, I know it's hard, I know, but it isn't your fault. Yeah? Whose is it?
Over the speaker, Parker said,
Mission Control's.
His breath sighed into the mic.
And mine. And God's. And yes, yours. And you'll carry that guilt. I won't pretend that you won't, but it is not yours alone. You did the best you could to keep Estevan safe.
At the sound of Tarazas's first name coming from Parker, Hafael crumpled. Fresh tears crowded around his eyes, building into mounds. Leonard snagged the towel from where it was floating and pressed it against Hafael's face. I let go of his hands, and he clutched the towel, weeping into it. I twisted, slipping out of the airlock so Cam could fit in. Her voice was cool and dispassionate. If you just listened, you couldn't tell that her eyes were red and swollen.
Just hold steady and we'll get you out of the suit.
If Hafael responded, it was lost behind the towel. As we worked to get him out of the suit, he slowly went limp and non-responsive. Cam kept up a steady, meaningless murmur as if her voice was a tether to keep him with us. At some point in there, Parker arrived and helped Cam get Hafael down to the med mod. That left me and Leonard to stow the suits. His jaw was tight as I helped him shuck out of his EVA suit. Our only conversation followed the checklist that the IAC had set up for post-extravehicular activity. When the last boot was secured in its bin, Leonard floated, staring at the empty spot where Tarazas' gear should go.
Oma, may I?
He brought his hands up to cover his face.
Could you?
All the tears I'd been fighting off burned at the back of my throat. I pushed over to wrap my arms around Leonard, and we both floated, spinning slightly, as our grief formed constellations around us. Hafael slept in the med mod. Four of us sat in the kitchen drinking the hot cocoa Florence had made for all of us. Leonard huddled under a gray wool blanket next to Cam, who stared into her cup as if it would speak to her. I clutched my own cup. It should have warmed my hands, but they still ached. Hours later, and my hands still ached from touching Hafael's suit. At least, that's what I told myself it was. In truth, every part of me ached, as if the grief had frozen all my joints the way that... I swallowed and picked up the mug. Parker slid down the ladder. His eyes were red around the edges, and he carried a bottle under one arm. Head down, he walked to the table and set brandy in the middle. Florence straightened and reached for it.
How'd you get this on board?
Get what on board?
Parker settled on the end of the bench next to me.
Mission Control strictly forbids alcohol on IAC ships to avoid cultural misunderstandings.
Cam snorted and slid Leonard's mug toward Florence.
I hate being used as an excuse. This is medicinal.
I slid my mug forward, too.
Doctor's orders.
Parker rested his head on both hands. He addressed the table.
I want to go over what we're doing with the body.
Not the bag.
Coco sloshed over Cam's mug.
That's what Mission Control wants us to use because Tarazas is already frozen.
No!
I shook my head, fury rising up my spine, and I reached for that heat gratefully.
God damn it. Nathaniel had said that we wouldn't.
But he wasn't in the office, was he? I clenched my jaw and swallowed so I could speak.
I recommend against that.
I agree.
Parker still kept his gaze fixed on the table.
Based on your report, it would traumatize an already traumatized crew.
Parker. Cam reached across the table and touched his elbow where it rested on the hard surface.
We're all exhausted and in shock. It might be best to wait for a bit.
I know.
He straightened and his face was military calm.
But I want this resolved before Avelino wakes up. I don't want him to have to hear us discussing it, so let's do our goddamn job and work the problem.
Leonard pulled the blanket a little tighter around his shoulders.
Estevan is still attached to the ammonia line, so we're going to have to finish cutting it to free him. That section should be completely clear of ammonia.
He swallowed.
Now.
It should have been clear before.
My voice was sharper than I intended. Leonard held up his hands.
The gauge read empty.
Stop!
Parker laid his hand flat on the table.
We are not looking to assign blame. We are working the problem of what to do with Estevan. At the current juncture, the line has been cut and is clear of ammonia.
And we have to do that EVA regardless, to repair the cooling system.
I nodded, trying to match the calm that we were all pretending to possess, as if this were just another sim.
I can go out with Leonard to clear the lines.
Then what?
Florence stood and walked over to the stove.
Do we bring him inside?
Leonard looked over his shoulder at her as she retrieved a mug.
He's got one arm stretched out. We wouldn't be able to bring him in through the airlock, and it would take some work still to get the lines off. There's a block of ammonia around his foot. It would take some work.
Except for Raphael, Leonard was the only one who had seen the problem. We could probably take the Busy Bee out for reconnaissance.
What about the Busy Bee? Could we load him in that?
To what purpose?
Parker's face was a blank mask.
Well, then we could work under atmosphere.
Leonard nodded.
Yes, I think he'd fit through the larger hatch, only...
He winced, tilting his head to the side.
That ammonia is going to thaw.
Florence set a mug of cocoa in front of Parker.
So wear Mars suit. Like you were telling Parker you'd do if you had to make replacement ammonia. You heard that?
Maybe I hear all.
Florence rested a hand on Parker's shoulder until he reached forward and picked up the mug.
I've got one job on this ship, and don't you dare say that laundry is that job. It's just because some folks are too foolish to do their own.
Parker stared into the mug.
We should decide what the end goal is.
He set it down again without drinking and stood. Grabbing a marker, he uncapped it and faced the whiteboard.
I figure we're looking at these options.
On the board he wrote, burial in space, storage for burial on Mars, storage for burial on Earth, the bag. At last, he drew a line through.
We've eliminated one.
Parker looked over his shoulder at us.
What other options are there?
The fans hummed as we all stared at the board. I half raised my hand and then put it down again, because truly the idea in my head wasn't a real option. Half a dozen things could go wrong with it.
York.
It's not. Someone else might get an idea from it. That was the point of this exercise. Incineration. Parker's lips pursed for a second before he nodded and wrote that on the board, too.
Any others?
Leonard raised his hand. I don't know why we'd started doing that like we were children in a school.
Instead of ground burial on Mars, how about a re-entry burial on Mars?
Parker nodded and wrote that and also re-entry burial at Earth.
Anyone else?
The fans hummed in concert with the refrigerator and the quiet pings of the ship as the ring segment rotated through space. I took a sip of my cocoa, which was too sweet, and coated the insides of my mouth like glue. Setting the mug down, I reached for the brandy. Still staring at the board, Parker asked,
any guesses on which you would have wanted?
You should ask Huff.
Cam stopped herself and stared down at her mug.
I don't want to bother him more than I have to. Bad enough that he feels responsible for this without putting that burden on him.
No, it's just that they were close.
Cam looked down, lower lip tucked between her teeth. I suppose it's a sign of how much the world had changed since the meteor that I had already known this. The way they spent all their off-duty time together, all the times I'd seen them touching. Raphael saying that he knew who the condom belonged to. Glancing around the table, I saw that same awareness sitting in the others, but the world hadn't changed enough that any of us would say it aloud. Even with Cam's assurance that Mission Control had known this kind of thing was not uncommon, they were both military men. Parker sighed and rubbed the back of his neck.
All right. Let's work the problem on each scenario. Shamoon, may I ask you to present the options to Avelino for his opinion? It might be better coming from...
Yes.
She nodded, fingers tight around her mug.
Times like this I wish I drank.
With the exception of De Beer, the entire crew of the Pinta came over to the Niña for Terrazas' service. It wasn't safe to leave both ships entirely uncrewed, and I was grateful to Binkowski for making the staffing choice he did. We sat in two uncomfortable rows in the garden area, listening to Vilbert and Graham play a haunting duet on flute and violin. Florence and I had dragged in the benches from the kitchen and the chairs from the med mod. I'd picked a spot in the back row between Benkoski and Florence. Directly in front of me, Raphael sat between Cam and Leonard. His posture was so rigidly correct that it hurt to look at. In front of him, across the radish bed, we'd made a sort of byre. Not that we were going to burn anything. Anyone. But we'd used small packing boxes and a locker door to create a raised surface above the gently waving green leaves. Cam had wrapped Tarazus in a winding sheet. His body lay almost like a mummy upon the plank. On the corner that lay over his face, Florence had stitched a simple Roman cross using blue thread that she had unraveled from his uniform. I'd taken some old punch cards and reports and cut them up, curling the edges and twisting them into a spray of flowers that rested in an ecru bundle on his chest. I think, being so far from home, we were clinging to every ritual or comfort we could. Even though Tarazus was Catholic, I had recited the mourner's Kaddish for him. Others were marking his passing as we had not been able to do for Ruby, or had been directed not to, I suppose. Either way, I think we all needed this, and I was genuinely grateful to Parker for ignoring mission control. Graham and Vilbert brought their song to a close and left us with the quiet susurration of the leaves and our own uneven breath. Parker stood from the front row and walked to stand next to Tarazus's body.
There is no good way to mourn the passing of a person. But we can remember him, and remember him well. Esteban Tarazus and I met for the first time during the war. We were on a base in Normandy, refueling. I flirted with a young woman who turned out to be his sister. Despite the fact that I outranked him and that they were in France as refugees, he suggested that this was not a good choice.
Parker gave a sideways smile and briefly met my eyes.
I will always remember that he has a solid right hook, and that he was fearless, loyal, and a complete payaso with his friends. I was proud to have him as a co-pilot, and even prouder that he granted me his friendship.
In front of me, Raphael's back was rigid. His shoulders had stopped moving, and I think he was holding his breath. I reached forward and rested a hand on his upper back. For a moment, Raphael leaned into my touch, and then the shell surrounding him cracked. Folding forward, he clapped both hands over his mouth, and even that didn't quite muffle the sound. Cam turned in her seat, but before she got there, Benkoski already had Raphael wrapped in his long arms. She pulled them both into her embrace, and they sandwiched Raphael. Leonard slipped forward and joined that huddle, which propelled me forward as well. All 10 of us wound up wrapping ourselves around him in awkward postures, hunched over benches, chairs, and each other. It was as if we were trying to make an ablative grief shield of our bodies. Times like this, you don't count in minutes or breath or anything except the waves of pain that ebbed and flowed through us. Raphael was not the only one weeping. I was empirical evidence of that. A pallbearer has a different role in Zero-G. Raphael and Leonard guided Tarazus's shrouded body down through the spindle and into the airlock. Except for that breach in the garden module, Raphael's hull of control had remained stable. Internal flaws are not obvious, though, and his apparent calm fooled no one. I think that's why Parker sent all of us to the observation dome before they opened the outer airlock. He probably would have sent Raphael, too, if it hadn't been obvious that he would refuse to obey that order. We clustered next to the windows on the port side. Not that port and starboard have much relevance in space, but old nomenclature dies hard. Heidi drifted over to me and floated with her arms wrapped around herself. At a funeral on Earth, there would have been small talk as we caught up and reminisced about the deceased. My urge to make pies and casseroles had been clawing at the underside of my skin for the past 2 days, but I couldn't for the life of me remember how to start a normal conversation. Though, perhaps, for the life of me is not the most appropriate phrase under the circumstances. The observation dome stuck out just far enough that we could look back along the length of the ship. We were sunside, so the ship gleamed against the ink of space. You never really get used to how deep that black is. The word deep? That is appropriate because it feels like something you could fall forever into. Which is, I guess, what we were about to do with Tarazus. The loudspeaker crackled on and Raphael's voice joined us.
Ladies and gentlemen.
His voice roughened, and he cleared his throat before starting again.
Ladies and gentlemen, in this thrilling installment, our intrepid adventurer Estevan Terrazas embarks upon an exploration of deep space.
Aft of us, a spray of paper flowers blew out from the side of the ship, followed by Terrazas's wrapped body. The winding cloth bound his body into a torpedo that followed the laws of inertia and floated alongside us. Slowly, our speeds diverged, and he drifted back, almost as if he were conducting an inspection of our hull. Oh, brave, intrepid adventurer. I had to turn away from the window and close my eyes. Lord, we'd gone to the moon together. My first time in space had been with this man, so many years ago, and I still remembered that as if it were in present tense.
Wait.
Terrazas puts a hand on my arm and then gestures to the windows.
Look.
There's nothing to see but that vast blackness. Intellectually, I know that we've passed into the dark side of the Earth. We slide into her shadow and then magic fills the sky. The stars come out, millions of them in crisp, vivid splendor. Look. I opened my eyes again to bear witness. Facing sunward, there were no visible stars in the sky, but my paper flowers caught the sunlight and seemed impossibly bright against the black of space. Terrazas spun as if he were taking in the glory of everything around us.
Oh, no.
Florence floated to the window and pressed her hand against it.
No.
No.
Shit.
She saw the impact coming before it happened, which gave the rest of us time to see Terrazas' body hit the antenna that pointed toward Earth. 27.
Chile takes over rails as strikes and riots spread. Santiago, Chile, May 20th, 1963. A growing wave of demonstrations by thousands of citizens over food shortages prompted the government to place the railroads under army rule today. The government also reinforced guards at strategic points and increased the number of police patrolling the city streets with water spray cannons.
Mission Control moved us all over to the Pinta because of the damage to the Niña. After 7 months of living with only 6 other people, the past 10 days had felt strange and claustrophobic. I pressed against the wall of the Monday morning staff meeting as the crews of both ships crowded into the kitchen on the Pinta. Parker and Binkowski stood at what felt like the back of the strangely disorienting room. The two ships were identical, or had been built that way, but 7 months of habitation by two very different crews had changed them. Some of the differences were blatant, such as the alpine border that Heidi had painted along the wall where wainscoting would go. That was easier than the small changes. For instance, the coffee cups were on the third shelf in the right-hand cabinet, not the first shelf on the left. And the silverware drawer, the spoons lay between the knives and forks, rather than to the right, which is where they should be. Why wouldn't you put them in the drawer in the same order they go on a table? Perhaps oddest was that they had put the whiteboard on the opposite side of the room from where we had it. Not that it made a difference, but I kept feeling like I was facing the wrong direction. Parker kept turning the wrong way when he reached for a marker.
All right. It's mission critical to get the Niña's cooling system back online along with our antenna. I know the Pinta team wants us out of their hair as fast as possible, but we're going to do this nice and slow and right. We'll take advantage of having both teams on one ship and combine forces. Now, Mission Control has put together a plan that they think will work. We're going to start with the cooling system.
Turning to the board, Parker wrote two names.
York, you and I will be on the bridge of the Niña. I want you doubling as my co-pilot for this, so start your prep now.
The entire room went hot as all my blood rushed to my face. It was like being in high school, younger than everyone else by 4 years, and getting picked for the kickball team. And not as a grudging last choice, but first. On the other hand, who was I kidding? All the blood drained down, leaving me cold. Parker followed the rules. I was Mission Control's choice, and he was accepting me because he obeyed orders.
Schoenhaus and Flannery, you're on the EVA. Avellino and Gray will help you prep. De Beer, you and Stuman are... Yes, Sabados.
Dawn's sharp cheekbones seemed poised to punch through her skin with disapproval. Mission Control said that Wilbert and De Beer should do the EVA.
Thank you, I am aware of that.
While Parker turned back to the board, Binkowski folded his arms over his chest and met Dawn's eyes. He gave a little headshake, which stopped her in the process of opening her mouth. On the side of the room, sitting against the kitchen counter, De Beer had his jaw set and his chin lowered as he looked out from under his brows. Leonard's mouth had rounded into an O of astonishment, and his color had deepened with a blush.
De Beer, you're going to be in the busy bee, so if there are any eventualities, you can pull our people in faster and get them immediate medical attention. Your first task is working with Shamoon to make any modifications you need to turn it into a floating sick bay.
That pairing worried me. On our trips over to do regular checkups of the crew, his racism had never been as blatant as it had been while he was sick, but little things always slipped through. None of them would have made it into a report to Mission Control, except as a line like, suboptimal communication between co-pilot and medical specialist.
Avelino, you, Schoenhaus, and Flannery are in charge of going over Mission Control's EVA plans with a fine-toothed comb. We've been out here for 7 months, and they don't know what our actual conditions are. Look for any hole, any flaw, any potential failure point. You have any doubts at all, I trust you over them. Clear?
Not sure anyone should trust my judgment.
Raphael gave a little shrug, staring at the floor.
Are you questioning an order?
Raphael jerked his gaze up. No, sir.
Then sit up straight and pay attention.
Parker jabbed his marker toward Raphael.
You have a job to do, and I damn well expect you to do it.
That was hardly fair. The man was still in shock and grieving. I mean, I know it wasn't his fault, but he was allowed to feel all the pain and self-doubt that came with... Oh, Parker was giving him a purpose. God damn it. I was happier being angry at him, but had to admit it was a good strategy. Parker tapped his pen against his palm and glared at all of us.
We are millions of kilometers from home. We haven't all been in the same room since we left Earth orbit 7 months ago. So let me remind you of a few things. One, I am mission commander. Two, Binkowski is second in command. Something happens to me, you obey him. And you obey him over what Mission Control says, because for all the brain power they've got banked down there, they can't see what we can. They can't know the nuances of our situation, which means they make mistakes. I made a mistake on the last EVA because I knew that Leonard was better qualified and I didn't push. So, you see a failure point, I expect you to bring it up. I expect you to work the problem. But I also know that none of you are failure points. The 12 of us in this room, we are our entire world. So do your goddamn jobs and let me do mine.
It was such a strange feeling to want to applaud Parker. May 22nd, 1963. Dear Nathaniel, I feel like a bad wife because I've been updated about your health, but it's still taken me several days to write to you. I'm sorry it's been so long, although I'm sure you understand why. The hours have been long, and I haven't wanted to ask Florence or Dawn to spend extra time at the teletype. Florence chivied me into it, for which I am grateful. I guess you already know that Vilbert and Leonard managed a partial repair on the ammonia system. All of us are looking forward to having it at full capacity again, partially so we can bring all the systems back online, but mostly so we can go home. The Pinta crew has been gracious, but having us all crammed into one ship means we're constantly tripping over each other. You would think it would reduce the workload since we could split it among more people, but we just seem to be creating more work for each other. I imagine that's what it'll be like for you when Thomas arrives. Please tell me that he's still coming out to intern with you. Mostly because that will mean you are well, and hopefully he'll make sure you eat on a regular basis.
I see the face you just made.
Yes, even from millions of kilometers away. Remember that I can nag from any distance. Other aspects of marriage require proximity, so I look forward to when we are in the same gravitational field again. All my love, Elma. There is something strangely satisfying about making a pie crust. You take three ingredients and they turn into magic. While I would have preferred to do a true butter crust, the butter-flavored Oleo that they'd sent with us was shelf-stable and not bad. On the other hand, I'd been eating in space for so long that my bar for not bad had lowered significantly. Fortunately, so had everyone else's, so my chocolate chess pie still worked as a bribe. With any luck, it would put everyone in a better mood. We'd been on the Pinta for 2 weeks now, and the cramped quarters made everyone tense. I gripped the bowl against my hip to steady it as I cut the oleo into the flour with a fork. I'd already made the filling, which sat on the counter in a chocolatish soup. Through trial and error, I'd learned that when using powdered milk, I got a better consistency if I let it sit before baking, one of the many adaptations to space that the IAC didn't anticipate. Much like what it would really be like to put both crews on a single ship. Behind me, some of the crew of the Pinta were using the kitchen as a recreation space. I guess they'd picked this room over the observation dome, which worked out well for sharing. Last I'd seen, Florence and Cam were up in the dome. Dawn and Heidi had added a makeshift table, made from a crate lid and a box, and had a jigsaw puzzle going, which showed a partial view of a Venetian canal. De Beer sipped a cup of coffee while poring over an old newspaper from home. Funny, the things we do for comfort. After a while, the parts of the paper that you never normally read become sources of comfort. I'd found myself engrossed in the baseball pages just because they contained words like Chicago and San Francisco. With the flour and butter cut into fine breadcrumbs, I set the bowl back on the counter. Next up were 4 tablespoons of water. At home, I only needed 3, but the humidity was so low on the ships that it took a little more to get a good consistency. Rafael slid down the ladder into the kitchen. He had barely hit the floor when he pushed off again and used the rebound to land near De Beer. He slapped a hand-lettered sign against the taller man's chest.
"This was you? Could have been anyone."
De Beer pushed Rafael's hand away, exposing the full sign. Colored restroom. I slammed the measuring spoons on the counter.
You asshole!
It was over the zero-G toilet.
Rafael ripped the newspaper out of De Beer's hands.
Vai vender, macaco!
De Beer surged up out of his seat, shoving the chair back. He had a good 7 centimeters on Rafael and used all of them to loom over him.
Don't you dare touch me. Why, am I too dark for you?
Rafael put both hands on De Beer's chest and shoved.
Are you dirty now?
De Beer pushed back, and then they both just snapped, fists and words flinging around the room. I ran forward.
Guys! Stop! Stop! This isn't...
I had to dodge backward as they tumbled toward me. Dawn chose a more useful course and ran to the wall intercom. She slapped the button.
Parker, Binkowski, fight in the kitchen. Request aid ASAP.
Heidi and I both circled around the men. De Beer had blood streaming out of his nose. Rafael nailed him with another punch to the gut, but came in too close, and De Beer grabbed him. They tussled, spinning around like a pair of angry cats. I reached back for the bowl of chocolate filling and flung it at their heads. The syrupy mess smacked into both of them, coating their eyes and cheeks with mud. Sputtering, they broke apart just enough that Heidi and I could push between them. I got my hands on Rafael's chest and tried to stay between him and De Beer. Beneath my hands, Rafael's heart beat against his chest like a series of sonic booms. This close, I could see he wasn't just angry, but had tears streaking his cheeks and mixing with the chocolate.
Please!
I dug my fingers into his flight suit, trying to keep a grip on him.
Please don't!
De Beer?
Heidi grunted and staggered into my field of vision. A moment later, he barreled into Rafael from the side. My hands were tangled in his flight suit, so I staggered along with them.
What the hell is going on?
Parker grabbed De Beer, throwing an arm around his neck and hauling backward. Binkowski pulled Rafael back, too. I let go. Sticky chocolate coated my hands. Now all the adrenaline made itself known. My hands shook, and my pulse pounded in the backs of my knees and heated my neck.
I repeat, what the hell is going on?
Parker had somehow gotten De Beer's arm twisted up behind him and had forced the man to his knees. Chocolate coated the front of his flight suit. Both men glowered at the floor, but their damned military honor kept them quiet. They'd throw a punch, but God forbid they snitch. The evidence of their fight was all too clear, though, even if I hadn't thrown chocolate on them.
York, status!
Parker turned his glare on me. I suppose I have just as much pilot's honor as they did because I did not want to get Rafael in trouble. If De Beer had instigated it, I wouldn't have hesitated. But the military would turn a blind eye to the sign. All that would matter was that Rafael began the physical conflict.
York, you were in the thick of it when I came in, and I'm covered in chocolate. Status! Now!
Sighing, I bent and picked the sign up off the floor. De Beer put this up on the zero-G toilet. De Beer winced. At first, I thought it was because he had been confronted with his sign, but his breath hissed in slowly. Parker had cranked his arm higher up his back.
That your work?
Behind Raphael, Benkoski rolled his eyes.
Jesus Christ, Van!
How the hell had De Beer gotten cleared for this mission? He didn't back down, even a little. He jutted his chin toward Raphael.
No one else saw this except him. Maybe he put it there.
Parker switched to Afrikaans and bent his head to De Beer's ear.
Behanen met un viskunen in laut my hluedet, of jais salni on marsh rauchni.
Whatever Parker said to De Beer caused him to pale a little. He wet his lips and had a moment of blinking in bewilderment at the taste of chocolate.
Am I to get an apology from him as well?
I could have slapped him, but that would have been useless. Still tempting, though. What surprised me was that Raphael had succumbed to the temptation. He was probably the least volatile of all of us. On the other hand, he had reason to be unsteady now.
Poor guy.
In Benkoski's grip, Raphael had sagged, so it looked more like he was being supported than restrained. He lifted his head.
I am sorry that I struck you. It would have been more appropriate for me to take my concerns to my SO. I apologize for the problems I have caused, and for wasting Yelma's pie.
You could almost feel the gravity in the room shift to De Beer. I wouldn't have been able to stand being under the weight of all of those gazes. Parker had not relaxed his grip at all, and the pressure caused De Beer to bend forward. Maybe Parker tweaked De Beer's arm further, or maybe he finally realized that he wasn't going to convince anyone that he hadn't made the sign. Whatever the cause, he let his breath out in one explosive rush, free shoulder sagging.
It was a joke.
Funny thing.
Parker bent over De Beer's shoulder, but he was staring at me.
Turns out, that doesn't stop it from being offensive. Also, not an apology.
My breath caught in my throat. De Beer hadn't apologized, but had Parker just apologized to me?
You're both confined until you've had a chance to cool down.
Parker released De Beer's arm.
Benkoski, you got them?
Confirmed.
He released Raphael and stepped back, hands on his hips to look at both of them. Heidi, Dawn, and I stood awkwardly for a moment as Benkoski led Raphael and De Beer away. I walked over to the counter to grab a towel. Behind me, Parker said,
"Next time, York, don't throw the batter on them."
It was the first thing I could grab.
Sure, but it's a waste of a damn fine pie.
Parker cleared his throat.
Sabados. Don't send that to Mission Control. I don't want it to get into the news back home. We'll deal with it internally.
I stared at the letter I'd written to Nathaniel, chewing my lower lip. Much as I wanted to tell him about yesterday's fight, I agreed with Parker about keeping it out of reports. The corner of the paper stirred in the breeze from the fan circulating air in the observation dome. Leonard floated in the dome, too, reading the latest data from the Mars orbiter that had been circling the planet since dropping the Friendship probe. With De Beer released from confinement, I didn't like leaving him alone, but I wanted to go to comms when Florence was on shift, and Leonard was an adult. Clearing my throat, I pushed off to float a little closer to him. I'm heading down to comms. Holler if you need anything.
I'll be fine, Alma.
He lifted his head, countering the movement with a twist of a hand to keep himself from spinning. I know, I just... The fact that both of us had had the thought that it might not be fine was a giant glaring red alert. I hadn't managed to work that problem, though. Not yet. I twisted in the air and pushed toward the hatch. One of the ways in which our crews had handled the merger was that Florence was sending the letters for the Nina crew, and Dawn handled them for the Pinta. It had the effect of making me reluctant to write, and knowing that Florence had to key in the letters made me keep them short. I didn't want to give her additional reasons to resent me by making more work for her. I assumed Nathaniel was keeping them short for similar reasons. Our rapid back-and-forth exchanges had been cut out with the garbage. I kicked down the spindle toward comms with a letter folded in my flight suit pocket. Ahead of me, Parker hung in the spindle just outside the comm mod. As I closed the distance between us, I flipped to orient myself with him. He barely glanced away from the door. The tension on his face. I did not like it. Grabbing a guide rail, I pulled myself to a stop next to Parker. Inside, Dawn and Florence bent over the comms unit, while Raphael and Vilbert floated below them, looking at the innards of the teletype. What's...
We've lost contact with Earth.
28.
First Mars Expedition Mission Log, Commander Stetson Parker. May 29th, 1963, 11:47 a.m. Contact protocols completed. After 2 days, communication with the IAC not reestablished. York!
Parker's voice made me jump, spraying dirt around the garden room where I had retreated to try to stay out of the way.
Sorry, didn't mean to. Got a minute?
With my hand to my bosom like some bimbo out of the old Flash Gordon serials, I turned to face Parker. I was pretty sure he could see my heart pounding through my chest, but my voice was calm, at least.
Sure. I need your opinion on a staffing question.
I walked over to the tool rack, ostensibly to get the broom so I could salvage the dirt before it got tracked everywhere, but really so that I could let my jaw drop open in peace. Parker wanted my opinion? Mine. Wind whistled through my open mouth before I swallowed. Go on. When I turned back, he looked relieved. Who was this man? With a nod, he got down to business, and the confident pilot came back to the surface.
They can't find anything wrong with the Pinza's comms system. We can still get the remote guidance signals the Santa Maria is bouncing at us, but nothing from Earth.
In that hesitation, I saw why Parker was so troubled, even if he was masking it beautifully. We'd been out of contact with Earth for 2 days now. The problem might be on the IAC's end.
They have 5 radio dishes pointed at us and auxiliary systems for the auxiliary systems.
Right. It's strange to hope that something is wrong with your ship while you're millions of kilometers from home, because the alternative is that something terrible has happened on Earth. They would have spotted another meteor, wouldn't they? With all the satellites we had now and Lunetta? Surely everyone on Earth was fine and it was just an electrical thing here.
So it's still likely that it's us, and the best way to eliminate that possibility is to get the Niña fully back online and check our radio as well. Do you think Avellino can handle an EVA?
Gripping the broom, I swept the dirt I'd scattered into a little pile. He hadn't fought anyone else, but the grieving was deep. On the other hand, he was a professional and knew the Niña better than anyone. Yes, but maybe do a 3-person team? The way we did for the solar panel deployment. That way, if he runs into problems, there are 2 people who can guide him back in. Parker nodded.
That's similar to what I was thinking. So, you and Flannery.
This time I made an actual sound, somewhere between a laugh and a gasp, as if I'd been punched. Crouching, I scraped the little pile of dirt into the dustpan. Where does this sudden faith in me come from?
Sorry.
That was another apology. I clutched the broom just in case he turned out to be a space alien who had taken over Parker's body.
I'm aware that we haven't exactly been compatible in the past, but with Terrazas gone, you're the senior astronaut. I function better with a co-pilot.
He was staring at the floor, leaning against one of the raised beds. It suddenly and belatedly occurred to me that he had known Terrazas longer than any of us had. Parker was so good at that military mask of calm that I hadn't actually considered that he might be in mourning. He just got on with business. Straightening, I dumped the dirt back into the radish bed and then set down the broom and dustpan. I miss him, too. The muscles in Parker's jaw stood out in hard contrast to his relaxed body posture. His gaze stayed cast down to the floor, but he gave one of his signature sharp nods.
Good. I'll speak to Flannery and Avellino, and then we can all start working the EVA plans.
Parker straightened, turning toward the door without meeting my eyes.
Carry on.
Inside my helmet, my breath competed with the hiss of my EVA suit's fans. I kept my eyes on the delta pressure gauge so we could open the airlock into space. The airlock closest to the antenna wasn't big enough for all 3 of us to exit at once. Even if we hadn't each had gear for the repair, we couldn't have all fit in our stiff, pressurized EVA suits, so we were using one of the larger forward airlocks, which was designed for loading cargo into a busy bee. Outside the suit, our gear drifted from tethers, clanging metal against metal. The delta pressure gauge eased down as the air evacuated and left us drifting in an eerie silence. I floated forward, pushing against the suit's pressurized, rigid joints and undogged the hatch. Pulling it open, I reached through to clip the tether hook for my safety cable to one of the handrails that covered the surface of the Niña. Bail closed, slide lock, black on black. Next, I guided my bag of gear through and secured it as well. A tug of my fingers sent me floating through the broad hatch. Using one of the handholds, I translated down to the far end of the handrail to make room for Rafael and anchored myself with the local tether. Both tethers tugged me gently toward the ship. It doesn't happen in the NBL pool because of the water resistance, but in space they exert a steady pull, as if I needed a reminder that this was not a sim. My nails scraped the inside of my gloves as I tethered the bag of equipment to my suit so I could haul it with me down the outside of the spindle. Only when everything was secure and double-checked did I stop to look out. All the tight grief and anger in my chest unpacked a little as I floated in space. There is a part of me that expects it to be blue, because of the hours spent in the NBL pool with the mock-ups of the Niña. But space was a rich black. If the lights were off inside the ship and we were pointed nightward, you could see the stars, but there was always a barrier. On an EVA, I was still looking at space through glass, but with no limit to my field of vision. It doesn't matter how many spacewalks I do. The stars will never lose their wonder. Against that limitless black, they blazed. Our ship defined the only edge, etched in gold and silver by the sun. As Rafael reached out, I didn't start breathing again until he'd clipped on. He faced away from me, looking out over that expanse in one of the few leisure moments we would have during the spacewalk. While we waited for Leonard, I stared into the infinite. I don't think it will ever matter how many times I see the stars like this. It will always seem holy. Under my breath, I murmured, Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech ha'olam shehechianu v'kimanu v'chigianu lazaman hazza. Parker crackled in my radio.
Come again, York.
I was praying. Talking to myself?
In Yiddish?
Hebrew, actually. Of all the times to trigger his love of languages, this was not one I wanted to explain. We'll do a lesson when we get back.
Try to keep the channels clear until then.
As if he weren't the one who was asking me about language. But we were doing an EVA without being able to consult with mission control. And even after taking 3 days to plan it, Parker had to be feeling the pressure. I wasn't going to give him any grief for this. Yes, sir. Leonard clipped on and spun to pull the thermal shield into place over the airlock hatch. The hatch would stay open in case there was an emergency and we needed to get back in quickly. I prayed to God that we wouldn't need that contingency. As he turned from the airlock, Leonard said,
Niña, EV-1. All three spacewalkers are in position and ready to begin.
Confirmed, EV-1. We have you in our sights.
Let's get this done.
Rafael's urgency fairly pushed me away from the hatch. I propelled myself after Leonard with carefully placed grips on the handrails. As we worked our way down the spindle, my legs trailed after me like Superwoman. Of course, she didn't have a tether to keep her from drifting off into space. Coming untethered. That's my fear. As much as I love this view, it is impossible to forget that if you fall forever. But being afraid of that means that I'm very, very careful about clipping the tether hook and following proper tether protocol at all times. Bail closed, slide lock, black on black.
My nephew thinks I'm Superman because of this.
Leonard did not get chastised by Parker for chattering. I resecured my tether at the next handrail and kept translating down the ship. If Tommy could see me, he would be whooping with excitement. A lump filled my throat. Same with mine. Ahead of me, Leonard reached the stump where the antenna used to be. He hooked his feet into a foot restraint and reeled his bag of gear in. The Mylar container had a slender profile, nearly as long as Leonard himself. He had a spare pole for the antenna in order to give it some distance from the ship. Rafael and I stopped next to Leonard. I unspooled my foot restraints tether and inserted the plug into one of the WIF mechanical receivers that peppered the Niña's surface. The collar on the foot restraints bayonet dropped down to lock it into place, revealing the black line for visual confirmation. I still did the twist and pull check to make sure that was mechanically stable. Bracing myself, I slid my toes under the foot restraint's loop and rotated my heel inward so that I could slide the heel ridge into its restraining slot. Once both feet were restrained, I secured my bag to a handrail on the hull. Raphael floated by me. His bag idled in the vacuum, turning a little. It was hard to see through his helmet, but I think he was looking at where Tarazus's body had hit. You okay?
Absolutely.
Raphael began moving like an automaton brought to life.
Just reviewing the order of operations. Nothing I see here makes me think we need to change procedure. We'll start by removing and securing the damaged section.
I extracted the garbage bag from my gear. It was a clever design with layers of bristle that met in the middle. The bristles were easy to push through, but would hold a drifting piece of debris inside. Useful for zero-G when you needed to keep your hands clear. Snapping its retractable equipment tether to a handrail, I secured the garbage bag to a whiff where Raphael and Leonard could get to it easily. Leonard had oriented his foot restraint so that he was facing the broken shaft the antenna had been bolted on. Raphael, meanwhile, had begun tracing cables from the antenna. Some of them had snapped off cleanly, while others floated several meters out. Leonard unspooled a socket wrench from the MWS strapped to his chest and fit it on the bolt. As his stiff gloves slid off the wrench, he swore in a random language. Tethered to the MWS, the wrench didn't go far, but there's still that heart-stopping moment when you think you're about to lose a tool to space. I grinned through my helmet at him. Was that Latin or Greek?
Greek.
I helped him steady the antenna stump as he got the wrench back into place. You're not going to translate it for me, are you?
Go to the crows.
Leonard placed the wrench again and resecured his feet. His wrench slipped, but he didn't lose the tool.
There are a couple of reasons I like this one. First, it's ironic coming from the mouth of a black man.
I stared at him, trying to put that together. Because it's Greek? He laughed.
You're adorable sometimes. No, because of Jim Crow. So, go to the crows takes on this modern connotation that it didn't have in ancient Greece. It sort of becomes a don't throw me in the briar patch kind of thing.
He lifted the bolt from the base and handed it to me.
Please tell me you get that reference.
Yes, Briar Astronaut. Leonard gave a belly laugh that made his mic distort. My skin flushed with relief because honestly that joke was probably crossing a line. It's the sort of thing I could have said to Eugene, but I wasn't sure that Leonard and I had that sort of trust built up. I slipped the bolt into our garbage bag. So, what was the connotation in ancient Greece?
Burial was very important.
He placed the wrench on the next bolt and took a moment to make sure it was seated.
So, saying go to the crows meant that someone was hoping your body would just rot and get picked over by crows.
Beside us, Raphael had stopped moving again, a cable partially coiled in his hands.
Being unburied messed with their ability to participate in the afterlife, and
I put my hand on Leonard's arm to stop him, although in the pressure suit he saw the movement more than felt it. Want to hear my favorite Yiddish curse?
Sure.
And here, suddenly, I was stumped. There were a lot of wonderful options, all of which revolved around death or burial. Or were too close in other ways, like, trouble is to man what rust is to iron. Others were concepts that Mama wouldn't have approved of me knowing. I shifted the garbage bag closer on its tether to mask my dilemma. What was something Aunt Esther would say? And that unlocked a raft of them. A Yid hat 28% Pachet, 2% Zucker, und 20% Chutzpah. Parker's voice came into our helmet.
I've been trying to keep out of this, but what does that mean?
I thought you wanted me to keep the airwaves clear. Across from us, Raphael's eyes opened, and he resumed wrapping cable as if he had never stopped. Parker snorted.
You are tempting me with language.
It's something my Aunt Esther always said. A Jew is 28% fear, 2% sugar, and 70% chutzpah.
This explains everything.
Bless your heart. Bear in mind that I'm a Southern Jew, so the sugar percentage is higher. Leonard handed the next bolt to me for disposal.
You mean the sugar is all on the outside. Ain't no one going to believe your sweetness all the way through.
As Leonard's language dropped into the informal rhythms I heard from Eugene and Myrtle, I grinned with something like triumph. It was the closest I had come to feeling like part of a team in too long. Speaking of team. Rafael, what's a good Portuguese curse? He tied off the cable he was handling and moved on to free the next.
In Brazil, we don't do things to show off. We parry English there.
Parker whistled.
Ouch.
Which means?
We do it so the English can see.
Technically speaking, we did not all need to be in or near the Niña's comm mod when Florence powered up the system 2 days after we finished the repairs. In fact, everyone except Florence and Rafael could have remained on the Pinta. Instead, the entire crew came over. Ostensibly, this was so we could save on fuel for the Busy Bee by making only one trip across. The garden module needed tending. Cam wanted to make certain everything in the med mod was secured. Leonard needed the paper he'd been reading. I had reference books I needed for computation. Parker put up with all of those fictions. In the spindle, it felt like twilight with only every third light powered. The original plan had been to finish the ammonia system repair before the radio, but Parker and Benkoski had wanted to confirm that the communication blackout wasn't just a Pinta problem. And for that, we needed a second working long-range radio system. When all the panels were lit with green, Florence spoke into the mic.
Okay, Pinta, go ahead with the test signal.
In the Pinta's comm mod, Dawn said,
Nina confirmed. Commencing test signal.
I floated just above Leonard's head so I had a clear line of vision to the dials and gauges jumping in response to invisible waveforms. It's funny how you can have two simultaneous responses to the same stimulus. On the one hand, I was relieved because this meant that our repair had worked. On the other, my entire body sank as if despair had become a gravitational force. If the Niña's signals were good, then that meant the problem was on Earth. It had now been a week without contact. An hour, two, maybe even a half day, could have been chalked up to a malfunction. But with all of the IAC's resources, heck, with the resources of an entire planet, the fact that they were still out of contact left me cold. Nathaniel, what is happening at home? 29.
First Mars Expedition Mission Log, Commander Stetson Parker. June 10th, 1963, 11:13 p.m. Ammonia system repairs completed on Niña. Communication with IAC still not reestablished after 14 days.
One of the ways you can tell that I'm Southern and Jewish is by the strength of my drive to feed people. The Monday morning meetings on the Pinta did not take place over breakfast the way they had back home. Back on the Niña, I mean. I'm not sure why they didn't set out refreshments beyond coffee. Maybe Dawn and Heidi were trying to assert their roles as scientists and avoided homemaking. Maybe no one on their crew liked to cook. But it had been 2 weeks since we had heard from Earth, and I needed to cook. There are a few things more satisfying than the smell of fresh-baked biscuits. Given the powdered milk, dehydrated eggs, and artificial butter, these were not bad. Mama would have been appalled at their lack of layers and faintly chalky taste. But at a certain point, that became normal. Parker and Benkoski slid down the ladder and into the kitchen, one after the other, like a carnival ride. Benkoski lifted his head and sniffed.
I don't know, Stetson. I might change my mind about the split.
You can't have her. Parker walked over to the whiteboard. But we'll send care packages.
Split? I wiped the mixing bowl out in the recycle sink.
We'll go over it at the meeting.
Parker picked up a rag and tossed it to me.
Wet this for me.
It smacked onto my clean counter, leaving a grayish smear on the stainless steel. Of course. I set aside my mixing bowl and devoted my full attention to the needs of our mission commander, bless his heart. Wringing the water out from the rag, I managed to not say any of that out loud, though I may have wrung it a little too hard. Here you go. Secretly, I will admit to hoping it would hit Parker when I tossed it back, but he snatched the cloth out of the air like an intercept missile. He turned to the board and wiped away the notes scrawled across it.
Benkoski, set up a pilot nav comp breakout after the all-hands meeting.
I'm your secretary now.
You're my wingman.
I could make the argument that since you're on my ship, you're my wingman.
Second in command. Co-pilot. Right-hand man. Whatever. Parker tossed him a pin. It means you do the paperwork.
So that's why Parker needed a co-pilot. Shaking my head, I turned back to clearing the dishes. The swish of my rag competed with the squeak of marker on plastic. After setting the bowl in the UV sterilizing rack, I wiped down the counter. Really, it is amazing how much better I feel when the kitchen is clean. Opening the oven door, I checked on the biscuits. Despite theoretically being identical, in practice, at home, the Nina's oven tended to run a little hotter, and I was still getting the hang of cooking with this one. A waft of steam rolled out into the room, carrying the scent of browning dough and buttery deliciousness. The tops were beautifully golden brown. So noted. A slower, cooler oven seemed to do nice things for my biscuit concoction. I grabbed a pot holder and pulled the baking tray out of the oven. Whether out of generosity or the desire for praise, I turned with the biscuits to offer one to Parker and Benkoski. On the board, Parker had written a staffing list. In the way that happens, I spotted my name first. Next to it were the words, NavComp, co-pilot. Somehow, I did not drop the biscuits. I did squeak, though. Benkoski looked around.
Aw, man, you are an angel.
Thank you. I carried the biscuits closer, still staring at the board. They'd split the cruise again, and it looked like we were going back to our own ship. Careful, the pan is hot. Parker tucked his clipboard under one arm and grabbed a biscuit.
Thank you, ma'am.
Ma'am? Since when do I rate a ma'am?
Only when you're baking.
He waggled the biscuit at me and then passed it under his nose, inhaling with gusto.
Woman's place and all that.
I rolled my eyes. Of course. I walked right into that one.
Well, the rest of the time you're a computer.
I gestured to the board with my chin. Or a co-pilot? Benkoski clapped me on the shoulder with one hand and grabbed a biscuit with the other.
Congratulations on your promotion.
Wait, that's permanent? Parker shrugged as if this was no big deal.
You want the dirty roster where we shift crews around and put De Beer on the same ship as Flannery and Gray?
He couldn't be serious about wanting me as his co-pilot. Women still weren't getting staffed on piloting the big rockets down from Lunetta. Not even as co-pilots. What about Avellino? Watching me, Parker took a bite of the biscuit and chewed slowly. Swallowing, he wiped a lingering crumb away from his lips with a thumb.
I am writing nothing in the log but praise for him. Do you think that's accurate at this time?
When we'd finished the antenna repair and gotten out of the suits, one of Hafael's eyes had been obscured by tears. He hadn't mentioned it. Aside from his quiet and the occasional freeze, you wouldn't have known that anything was bothering him. But a co-pilot couldn't afford to freeze, not even for a moment. And what about my anxiety? I walked over to the counter to set the biscuits down. The other crew members would be arriving in a minute now. May I speak with you for a moment? Parker sighed and handed the clipboard to Benkoski.
Write up the rest of this.
Not a secretary.